This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid for it, eyes, put up a parking lot.
Well, growing up in the 80s, you could just take a blanket and a picnic down to the penguins at Phillip Island and you could just watch those gorgeous little things waddle in. But as numbers of tourists grew over the years, so did the need for infrastructure, Jono. Not everybody was happy at the time, but now, decades on, it's a huge international tourism destination.
And they get thousands of people going there every year. I think COVID would have put a little bit of a dent in that. But there's a similar thing happening when you go and see the penguins at St Kilda Beach as well. But they've brought in plans for tickets and infrastructure at St Kilda as well.
But this is not an issue just for penguins. It certainly goes beyond that.
That is correct. So from toilets along the Great Ocean Road to viewing platforms at the 12 Apostles.
From the 1,000 steps in the Dandenongs to rock jumping at Mount Martha.
When does infrastructure need to be built to cater for tourists? And when should nature just be left alone?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall.
Paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to
go? So when does infrastructure need to be built to cater for tourists, and when should nature be left alone? Another area that's been discussing this, and there's already a text that has come in on this that says, we don't want infrastructure on the surf coast, especially around Bells and Winkie. We fight it. And the community's been discussing this, Jono, for some time, trying to deal with the numbers that often get moved from Bells Beach down to Winkie Pot. Margaret Paul, who is a reporter, spoke to Sammy Jay about this just at the beginning of this week. And this is, I guess, an explainer on what locals do and don't want.
We're going to Bells Beach because there's a discussion that's been going on for quite some time about a 60-metre boardwalk at Winkie Pop, which, if you know Bells Beach, you've been down there during the surf pro times. Often they have to relocate the competition from Bells Beach to Winkie Pop Beach, which is just the next one around. But if you do that, there's nowhere to watch it. So there's been discussions about building a new timber and steel boardwalk to make that a bit easier. Now, in the latest kind of plan for the Bells Beach area, that's not in the plan. Hasn't been ruled out, but it's not in the plan. And it's very contentious down there because the issue of how much or how little to build around Torquay is kind of existential. It's kind of the issue around mm-hmm. that area. So there's a couple of councillors who are bringing that to the council meeting this week. They just want to rule it out. They want to say the council's position is to oppose that boardwalk.
And so that's part of the discussion happening around the surf coast at the moment. Should there be a boardwalk, a 60-metre boardwalk built at Winkie Pop? Well, Gary Dunn is a former editor of Trax magazine. He spent 17 years working at Rip Curl. And he's a local. He lives around the area of Torquay in Bells Beach. He's now working at the Torquay Surf Museum. G'day, Gary.
Good morning, Jono. How are you?
Very well. Should this boardwalk be built?
Look, I think the community's position is pretty. I think it's actually very solid, and the majority of people oppose the idea. One of the key things about Bells Beach and Winkie Pop is in the early 70s. I think it was 1971. Local surfers here managed to persuade the state government to designate Bells Beach and Winkie Pop as the world's first dedicated surfing recreation reserve. Now, you know, Bells was only had a road put into it from the Great Ocean Road in 1960. Between 1960 and 1970, between the grazing land that bordered the area and the number of surfers who started going there, there was a lot of damage done to the headland and the bush around there. And so in 1971, the locals went, we want to protect this place. for generations to come. And the locals have done an incredible job of revegetating that area with indigenous species of plants. There, you know, in the 70s, there was actually a surfing competition called the Conservation Contest. And one of the conditions of entry in that contest was actually to put a few plaques in the ground as part of the price of entering the competition. And, you know, since the early 80s, the work has continued. There are still monthly working bees that are run and, you know, do a lot of work protecting, you know, reinforcing the paths, protecting the fencing, and particularly the vegetation.
But, Gary, if it gets moved down to Winky Pop like it does so often, how do you protect the local environment, but how do you manage the numbers at the same time? I mean, there's a text here that says infrastructure needs to be built when tourists do not listen to advice and rules and damage the area. Infrastructure should be protective against damage occurring and, you know, things like traffic and access and whatnot.
Yeah.
If you're
going
to get thousands of people rocking up to Winky Pop regardless, what do you do?
I think it is a somewhat troublesome issue, but the reality is that it's at most 4 to 5 days of competition for the Bells Beach, the Rip Girl Pro, every Easter, and the locals, I think fairly rightly, believe that given that the volume of people, you know, only gets high when the competition is on, and you know, there's problems around spectators being able to view the competition if it's moved to Winky Pop. And again, the reality about that is it only happens for, you know, maybe a day or two of those 4 or 5 days of competition. And so, the locals haven't thought about this stuff, you know, just as with a NIMBY approach. You know, they look at it in the big picture. And for them, I think the reality is that, you know, part of the condition of Rip Curl continuing to have the competition at Bells Beach is that they leave nothing but footprint on the site.
Yeah, but see, Gary, is everyone doing that? Because, I mean, it seems almost as if history is repeating here. You're talking about in the 60s and 70s how, surfers were coming to Bells and there was a bit of damage being done to the headland, so there was a real reaction to that locally to make sure that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But how do you protect a place like Winky now? And if you put in a boardwalk, would that actually protect the environment instead of actually damaging it?
Look, there's a reasonable argument to suggest that a viewing platform, would help protect. But the fact is there are fences there already. They're slightly above waist height. And, you know, I first came down to Bells in 1988. At that time, there were no fences along the cliff top at Southside Bells, so the headland directly above Bells Beach. And spectators would often go from the park to the very edge of the cliff and sit and watch the competition. And the beach announcers were constantly calling them out and saying, first of all, it's actually dangerous to sit on the cliff top. And second of all, don't go tromping in there because we've, you know, put a lot of work into revegetating the headland. And so, you know,
relying on tourists to do the right thing, though. I mean, we're going to speak Great Ocean Road in just a moment, and there will be fences and things in places, and people still climb over bloody fences and often get really hurt and in instances get killed. Yeah. Just finally, Gary, are you confident that, I know when we spoke about Bells being moved, are you confident that Bells is coming back?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been speaking to my old workmates and friends at Rip Curl. They have a new contract. And the Victorian government, through Vic Tourism, has a new contract for the next 3 years, locking in Bells Beach at Easter as a World Championship Tour level event. So
good news.
There's no risk there. And, you know, what happens with the competition every year? They put up temporary grandstands so lots of people can see the competition more easily. Perhaps that's the solution for Easter at Winky Pop if they need to move.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's good that the pro is coming back to Bell's. I'm happy to hear that, and I guess it makes me feel better that when they did move it up to Merriweather at Newcastle and they didn't get amazing surf up there. So
we were all secretly a little bit happy, weren't we?
Yeah.
Not that we want to say that, but, you know, thought it, didn't say it. Good
Bell's
on you, Gary.
Bell's is better. Gary no Dunn is ex-editor of Tracks magazine and spent 17 years working at Rip Curl as well. He lives in the area, talking about the local opposition to a 60-metre boardwalk built of timber and steel and just some of the thought and discussion going on around that at the moment. Victor is in Chelsea. G'day, Victor. What did you want to say?
G'day, everyone. Look, I'm talking about the Penguin Parade, and I first came to Australia in 1980. And we went down to sit on the beach with the ranger, you know, and it was a really magical experience. You sat on the sand and the hundreds of penguins came ashore. About 10 years ago, I took my sister, who came over from England, and I was amazed to see us sitting in rows of wooden seats. We took my brother 2 years ago, and it is an embarrassment. Well, I've been asked not to mention prices, but if anyone would like to go, please Google the price that you're going to be asked to spend. And it's double if you wish to go in a protected little hut that they've built. The car park is the size of Disneyland, and the coaches are just enormous. As I say, the guides run round to these people saying, look, look, quick, come on, there's six penguins coming up here. And all of these foreign people run to see these six penguins. And then when they've gone, it's like, oh, look, there's another six coming.
Now, what about the argument, though, that you need to put that infrastructure in place to protect the penguins, the penguin burrows? They're incredibly sensitive. What do you say to that?
The infrastructure, the penguins, the ones that have got good common sense, don't land where you have the seats. The penguins go further down the beach. And I can only presume that ultimately the thing will die because it will not have any good reputation. I can't believe any visitor to this so-called, you know, wonderful
natural landscape.
Yes,
yeah, you're right, Victor, in that it's huge. It's certainly changed in the decades that I've been spending time down there. And the last time I went, John, the contrast was stark from a picnic blanket to, you know, what Victor was talking about. But most of the time, the ranger spent their times trying to tell people to please turn off your mobile phone. And I just felt so sorry for the rangers. Plenty of texts on lots of different areas because it's not just Phillip Island and it's not just the surf coast, but looking at all different parts in your community where infrastructure may have to be considered in order to cater for the huge number of tourists that come along. This that says one of the best things about the Surf Coast Beach and around Bell's Beach is that it is undeveloped. Natural coastline. It's maintained. It's got a sense of wild and a natural surf beach. That is what appeals.
Yeah, and there's a text here as well. I think this is a pretty controversial issue for the Surf Coast because this one says, are there even any locals living in Torquay or Janjuk, Bells anymore? The surf industry has led us to the demise of that area. We loved our family holidays there, but the town and the area has been overpopulated and the essence of the place has been destroyed. And that's not the first time I've heard people saying, are we loving the Surf Coast to death? Are we loving the Great Ocean Road to death? And I guess that's what we're talking about today, Rish. Are we... when do you develop something and how do you do that sensitively and how do you do it well?
Kathy's in Toora. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, what did you want to say?
Well, I've got a different story and Chino will laugh. He knows who I am.
I do. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Jono. We have a beautiful waterfall down in South Gippsland called the Agnes Falls. It's a 59-metre drop and is absolutely wonderful. But unfortunately, it's got a bit of a kink in it. So from the viewing platform that is already there, you can only see the top section and people actually climb over the barricades to get a better view, and it's very dangerous if they do that. So we've actually been crying out for at least the last 8 or 9 years to have a cantilevered viewing platform built, so that people will be able to walk out on that, have a wonderful, exciting experience. Those that don't want to don't have to, and they'll be able to see the full 59 metre drop and down into
and do
the
it
gorge.
Safely. Who pays for that, Cathy?
Well, I belong to a friends group, and we're just a small community group, so we've actually asked our local council to go for some grants for it. It's on Parks Victoria owned managed land. Parks Victoria tells us they don't have any money whatsoever, or even though they've just spent $23 million down at the prom, or they're proposing to, they couldn't spare $500,000 for our viewing platform. But so we've been trying for a number of years to get government grants, and the council's been trying to get government grants as well, and hasn't been lucky so far. And then the money was provided by the local council. They thought it was such a fantastic project, but then the council went into administration, and unfortunately the money was withdrawn.
Oh, Cathy, how many people, John, if you know the area, how many tourists or visitors go to that particular waterfall?
Yeah, so this is beautiful. This is Agnes Falls, and you just turn off from Tura in South Gippsland. It is just absolutely beautiful, and I dare say there would have been heaps of water flowing over it over the past few weeks. But I don't know exactly on visitor numbers, but they do get quite a few, particularly if you're driving along the South Gippsland Highway. You just turn off and head up, and it's just a beautiful little detour. Simon is in Roeville. Good morning, Simon. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Look, I'd start from the proposition that these national and state parks are just the sad, pathetic remnants of what used to be there. They're supposed to be for conservation. They're not there for people to economically exploit. In fact, they've been specifically carved out away from that.
But if that the argument is, Simon, that it's the opposite, that you're going to get thousands of people going to some of these beautiful places, that you need to protect the environment because people are going to rock up there anyhow, do you not think that argument holds?
No, absolutely not. Now, I'd give a classic example of Mount Buller.
Yep.
My uncle, I was at his funeral a few weeks ago, and it was pointed out that when he started going to Mount Buller in the 50s, they used to have to ski up the mountain to get to the top so they could ski down.
Well, I don't know how feasible that is either. I mean, but look, yeah, things have changed. But I think getting those little lift thingies, you know, probably a good thing, Jono, when it comes to people's safety at the snow.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Let's have a chat with Catherine Basterfield, who is the CEO of Phillip Island Nature Parks. Good morning. Now, firstly, we had a caller just a few minutes ago, Catherine, called Victor. He was saying that, well, he was kind of comparing what your operation there to Disneyland. He was saying it's too big, it's overdeveloped, and it's lost its charm. What do you reckon?
Yeah, good morning, Jono. I did hear a little bit about that discussion, and obviously have a different view to the Penguins operation. But, obviously Phillip Island receives so many visitors over the course of the year, and the Penguin Parade does too particularly. We've got some great examples of where infrastructure has worked well to protect the environment, and we've got some great examples of where infrastructure was just created in the wrong place and needed to be reversed. So in terms of the Penguin Parade and the protection of that colony, you know, the tourism, yes, it's busy, yes, it's crowded, but tourism has really driven conservation outcomes on the Summerlin Peninsula. So we've gone from, in the 1980s, the prospect of the penguins on Phillip Island absolutely declining or being locally extinct by the mid-90s was the prediction at the time, to now having a thriving colony of 32,000 penguins.
How has tourism helped that?
Tourism's paid for it. So our tourism venues on Phillip Island drive the conservation work that we do. And we've had supportive state governments who have made some really substantial change to help remove infrastructure and protect the penguins on land and expand their habitat. So on Phillip Island, the area of land that Phillip Island Nature Parks manages over the course of the last 50 years has mostly been farmland donated back and revegetated by the community to create parks. So we're in the situation that we're now managing land that has been rehabilitated rather than degraded over time, and Phillip Island Nature Parks is continuing to progress that improvement and re-establishment of land that we lost and wildlife that we lost.
So it's understandable, as CEO of Phillip Island Nature Parks, that you would hold up the Penguin Parade as an example of good development, but you also said you know of examples of bad development as well. So what are you talking about there?
Yeah, so on the Summerlin Peninsula, which is where the Penguin Parade is located, the area between the penguins and Seal Rocks, which is at the other end of the peninsula, sort of in the mid-50s, a township was established on that peninsula site. So 770-odd blocks of land and in the end about 150 houses were built on that peninsula. And the traffic and the domestic animals and the just the vehicles and the lights and the nighttime activity really had a negative effect on the local wildlife, and particularly that was one of the main reasons that was leading to the loss of penguins. So we had an amazingly brave state government at the time in the mid-80s, led by John Cain and Joan Kerner, who sought to buy back that whole Summerland estate and return it to a natural environment. So that's one example of where some bad decisions were made, did absolutely negatively impact the environmental values of an area, and was bravely reversed.
And just lastly, before we let you go, Catherine, Victor, who was on earlier, was saying it's just too expensive as well. Do you get people saying that it's too expensive to come and see the penguins?
No, we don't get lots of feedback on price. We do get feedback, or we did, particularly when we had a high volume of international visitors, get feedback on how crowded it is. But from a value for money, I think most people understand that what they're paying for that experience is going back into improving the environment. So we don't necessarily get too much feedback on that.
Catherine, thanks so much for your time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Catherine Basterfield, she's the CEO of the Phillip Island Nature Parks. And we're talking about all areas of tourism infrastructure, maybe just how you've seen it change in your local community over the years. This is interesting. It says tourism infrastructure would actually be more acceptable if it wasn't so ugly, especially in parks. I do often wonder sometimes about where those designs come from. But we mentioned Mount Martha before. Now, there is a Jumping Rocks there. Now, I've actually never been, but we know that lots of people go there and that, you know, that locals aren't always happy. And Amanda says, hey guys, yep, I've lived in Mount Martha now for over 40 years, and like most residents, we've had enough of the rude, disrespectful, abusive tourists that block our driveways, use the esplanade as a footpath, even defecate, leave their hard rubbish scattered amongst vegetation on the cliff tops, contributes to the erosion of the cliffs. Infrastructure around the pillars would only exacerbate these issues. There is simply no room for it. The text is quite long and it goes on. My beautiful hometown is not so idyllic anymore, from Amanda. It's a really tricky one, you know. Where do you find that balance? If people are going to go there anyhow, do you build infrastructure or do you just try and stop people from going there? And can you?
Yeah, and this reminds me of a little place called Metung. A couple of years, well, it's probably about 20 years ago now, there was a natural hot springs, and there still are natural hot springs there, but you used to be able to just get in for free and you could kind of hop in this little spa set up and just get some, you know, just sit in this beautiful warm water. But then they closed that off, they capped them, and now they're building this, what's kind of a resort, a wellness retreat, all the, you know, all the trimmings that come along with that.
A boutique and what's the line?
A swinging hotspot,
yeah, exactly.
I think Joni Mitchell said. I'm not sure if I've seen plans for a swinging hotspot in Metung. But the other big one that comes to mind is the cable car in Tasmania at Hobart on Mount Wellington, or Kunanyi, as it's also known. For years, and I'm talking decades, there's been discussions around Hobart about whether there should be a cable car from Hobart all the way up to the top of Kunanyi, and it's just, it continues on. I think it was in the news even as recently as this week, because 10 Aboriginal Heritage Officers have lodged a submission to the Hobart City Council against that proposed cable car. So it just continues on. And this is the crux of it. Mm. Where do you draw the line about what is sustainable and healthy development and what is going to be good for the environment?
But the Great Ocean Road, gosh, where do you start there, from more toilets possibly being a point of discussion, so to speak, looking at infrastructure around the 12 apostles or however many there are left of them, tolls, you name it. Terry Smith is from Go West Bus Tours and has been driving up and down that coastline for years and years. I make you sound really old now, Terry. But I mean, looking at infrastructure and how you cater for tourists, how problematic is it to keep everybody happy, do you think?
Oh, geez, Rochelle, you're never going to keep everyone happy. That is the one thing that you can be absolutely guaranteed by. It's interesting. Every time I think about progress, and of course progress is a very much a debatable thing, I'm reminded of the fact that I drive on a fairly regular basis past a location in Kew where there was a sign saying we will oppose inappropriate development on the fence of this fairly stately sort of a home. And there was a lot of development going on around, and unfortunately that particular block is now flat. The house is gone and it's going to be itself developed. So, you know, trying to stand in the way of progress is, I think, a relatively futile sort of a thing to do, which is not to say that, that you know, residents and so on shouldn't try to maintain what they like. In saying that, let me give you two examples of the Great Ocean Road. When I first started taking sightseeing tours to the 12 Apostles, you used to drive on the Apostles' side of the road. There, some people might remember there was a drive-through sort of horseshoe-shaped car park there. We used to pull up right at the top of the steps where the amazing Apostles' view along the coast is. Guests would literally get out, being able to see the Apostles and walk straight down the steps, or we would drive all of about 15 to 20 metres, if we were unlucky, and park our bus. But of course, in those days, visitor numbers were much, much, much lower. The other one that really springs to mind is the fact that when you drive down to the Great Ocean Road, assuming you go through Torquay, once upon a time it was a very small place, and now it is, suburbs upon suburbs, and new housing developments as far as the eye can see. So, are you ever going to stop it? No. I think it's a question of how we can do it as tastefully and as appropriately as possible, and have something that really fits in with the landscape.
I was thinking, just as you were speaking, that was probably when there were actually 12 apostles, when you could pull up right next to it. Was that?
There's never been 12 in my experience going down there. There is that's the famous question one tries to avoid any conversation about how many there actually are, because it is sometimes in the eye of the beholder.
But has there been some opposition to, you know, that initially when it was being developed along the Great Ocean Road and the 12 Apostles, was there opposition there? I feel like we just touched on this this idea about a boardwalk at Winky Pop just near Bell's Beach, and we've had heaps of texts of people who are opposed to it. So how controversial has it been?
Look, yeah, Winky Pop and the whole Bell's Beach Surfing Recreation Reserve is a really controversial one. Some many years ago, used to make Bell's Beach the first destination where we would actually stop, having departed Melbourne on our Great Ocean Road tour. And it was a convenient stop for us, because not only was there an attraction there, but there were also, of course, bathrooms. And those of us who've been to Bell's Beach might know that the bathrooms there are actually a bit of an attraction in themselves, because they've got a mural painted all the way around them. So people would not only take the opportunity to use the bathroom, but also, make it a bit of a sightseeing stop. That is one of the great challenges of operating tours, is that you've got to provide bathroom opportunities for your guests, but you don't want to make bathroom stops where there's nothing else to do. So it's sort of a question of those getting off the bus, go to the bathroom, and the rest of us sit there and watch them get off and go to the bathroom and twiddle their thumbs until they're all done. But of course, some years ago now, and I'm sure you probably talked about it on your own program, there was the decision that tour operators would essentially be barred from going to the Bell's Beach Surfing Recreation Reserve unless they had a permit. And, then they started charging fees, and subsequently we actually became aware of the permit application process being open after it was closed. Seemed to have no trouble getting a letter to tell us that it closed and we'd missed out, but somehow missed the letter telling us it was now time to apply. But that's another story for another time. So, and it was quite a vigorous and, to be completely honest, somewhat unpleasant campaign by some of the local surfing community, where on one occasion I received a call from one of our drivers to tell us that surfers had parked vehicles directly in front of and behind our bus to stop them from leaving. So, you know, that was it was controversial, but in the end we had to simply adapt our itinerary.
I guess that just shows how heated these issues can get, and that's that whole the locals versus tourism argument has been around forever. It does feel like it's really at the forefront at the moment, though, especially in places down like the Surf Coast. Tolls is something that's been discussed along the Great Ocean Road for a long time as well, because, of course, who pays for this stuff, you know, is what we hear time and time again, whether it be boardwalks or toilets or upkeep or cleaning. Tolls possibly is one of that. But I guess that's the other thing, Terry, is who pays for this infrastructure?
Yeah, look, it is the great challenge of the Great Ocean Road region that very little money is actually spent in the region by visitors. I remember a study coming out that visitors were spending something like, on average, 17 cents per visitor simply because there was really, in the Port Campbell area, unless you're stopping in the town of Port Campbell for a refreshments break, there's really nowhere to spend money. I'm not actually personally against the idea of tolls. I've always been of a view that, you know, users pay, and as long as it's an equitable system that applies to everyone, then I've got no issue with paying a toll as long as each and every one of my competitors is the same and I'm not therefore at a competitive disadvantage. You know, we drive home inland and we go through the Corangamite Shire and nobody stops. There's not a single tour bus that stops in the Corangamite Shire, and while our vehicles are the smaller 24-seater vehicles, I sometimes have had the pleasure of travelling behind much larger vehicles, seeing the wear and tear that they're doing to the roads, and that particular shire having to be responsible for paying for the upkeep.
I know, and that's an argument we'll probably get to another time, and I know it's one that's ongoing. There's a text here from Lou in Borwin for you that says, I love Terry. He's such a smart and hardworking tourist entrepreneur. I hope that tourists turn up again soon so he can get back to what he's good at. I guess that's our final question to you, Terry, is how's it all going? I mean, obviously you haven't been able to drive your bus tours for some time. Are you confident that your business will stay up and running?
Get up and running would be the more appropriate terminology, Rochelle. You know, we are presently really, frankly, deeply hibernated. We actually have a tour coming up on Friday week. We've got a group of international students who wanted to go to the snow, found out they couldn't go there due to COVID restrictions in the past, have engaged us to take them to the Arrow Valley. And I literally had a phone call an hour ago from the organiser of that group asking, well, what are we going to do if the regulations change again and we can't travel? So, you know, we're in that odd situation where we're working with and as responsibly as we can with the organiser of the tour. You know, we haven't taken payment yet. We normally would have taken payment in advance, etc. But you've just got to, you know, work within what you've got. We cancelled a thing the other day for a Lebanese wedding. We were going to do a transfer. They simply couldn't take the group size to any location and get together. So that's being postponed to another time. Given that we work predominantly with international visitors, we're probably looking at another 12 months. And, you know, that's nobody's idea of fun. But what can we do? We can only control what we control. So that's what we focus on.
Yeah, well, hopefully by the time we catch up with you next time, it'll be, well, a bit smoother time. Yeah. So thank you, Terry, for your
Always
experience. Terry Smith, who runs Go West Bus Tours, and they run tours along the Great Ocean Road. And lots of texts on that this morning, Rish. This says, one of the best things about the Surf Coast around Bells Beach is that it's underdeveloped. It's a natural coastline. It's maintained its sense of wild and natural surf beach, which is what appeals. And also someone, Chris from Fernie Creek, who says, yes, I am a local. The thousand steps gets far too crowded at the weekends. Visitors need to be discouraged. And a good way of doing this would be to introduce a modest parking fee, say $1 a visit. I think this is inevitable. Chris from Fernie Creek. So thank you for your text.
And Stephen in Geelong says, hey, sorry, guys. Sorry, Torquay locals. Not building a boardwalk won't stop people coming and surfing your waves. Yep. Well, Freya Higgins Debioles is a senior lecturer in tourism management at the University of South Australia. And looking into the impacts of tourism on small communities, Freya, is kind of your specialty. Is this a debate that has been around since the beginning of time?
Well, it has been since modern tourism took off, and I'm so happy to see that your audience is interested in this, because it's one of the least sexy topics about infrastructure and toilets and so on, but I can see that there's a real interest in it. It's a really important topic.
And so where do you come in on this? I mean, what do you think should, how do we balance tourism infrastructure with the appeal of a place?
Well, that's a great question, Jono. The thing that I'm concerned with is it's the local communities who live with a place, and it's they that have to see it day in and day out after the infrastructure is built. So I think the way that we can come to terms with this is to ensure that the local communities have a chance to have their input and their insights into the policy and the management process. And I think we need to be clear that these things come with cost, you know, not only in terms of dollars, but the infrastructures create possibly negative impacts on the environment. They create an impact on the aesthetics of a place, just as you said, this comment said about Bell's Beach, that the attraction was the underdeveloped nature of the place. And then there's this issue that there's a slippery slope, that once you start to bring in infrastructure, that then attracts more people, which then necessitates more development, more infrastructure, and so on. So how do we get to a balance in this? How do we address this? We do have coastal regulation, for instance, and zoning and those things, which are meant to manage it. But what I think is happening is you've got this imposition coming from tourism authorities, or in some cases, events authorities, and then impacts of tourism changing and becoming much more diverse and unpredictable through things like Instagram. So, you know, a place that's totally off the beaten pathway can become an attraction very quickly with Instagram.
And I'd forgotten about that, because we saw that even at Sea Lakes, didn't we, in Victoria, just little place in the middle of, you know, central Victoria.
Exactly, and it can happen overnight. And then that begins to pressurize authorities to do something quickly. So that makes the management and the policy context much more difficult.
And so who pays for this kind of infrastructure? We've been talking a lot today about the boardwalk on the Surf Coast and how controversial that is. This is at Winky Pop, just, you know, in case the pro gets moved from Bell's Beach to Winky Pop, which has happened before. Who do you think should pay for it?
Well, often the development will happen through grants and subsidies coming from various levels of government. So it can be very complex how that happens. I think one of the things is about the upkeep of it, though, is what is the nature of the upkeep required around that infrastructure afterwards. And I'm in favor of tourism taxes. You know, it's the tourists who are causing the need for the infrastructure. So in places like Kangaroo Island, where I've done my research, there's often talk about creating a tourism tax. But governance authorities and the tourism industry are often opposed to the impositions of tourism taxes because they say that will dampen demand. But, you know, perhaps dampening demand in some places is what we want.
It's funny, there's a text here that says, I don't understand the reluctance to charge people to use public toilets. You do that all over Europe sometimes to a visit. Tourists will pay. So that's one part of it as well. But Freya, when we look at, okay, well, you know, like Winky Pop as an example, if a boardwalk was to be built there, which it looks like it's not going to, but it only gets used for one time of the year, how can it then be used for the other 11 months of the year by locals? You know, is there a way of providing something that maybe would benefit the locals 90% of the time and tourists 10% of the time?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's what the locals want and enjoy. So that's where community engagement, community feedback is so important. And often that doesn't happen. So, for instance, I did research on the KI Pro Surf and Music Festival in 2011, and there was a lot of controversy about the building of a viewing platform that became permanent. And the community only found out about the event being scheduled by the local newspaper, the KI Islander newspaper. So I think it's community input into these things. And in the case that you're talking about, if it's not used by the community, perhaps there's a possibility of temporary infrastructure.
And how much does this come down to funding for organisations like Parks Victoria? Because we've got a text here saying Parks Victoria is underfunded and that includes the prom. So in your research and in your work, do you think that state government agencies like Parks Victoria here need more funding?
oh, they definitely need more funding. And what happens because they're poorly funded is they have to be relevant to tourism authorities that then sees these parks authorities allowing tourism developments that often undermine the pristine nature of some of the protected areas that we're zoning to be no-go zones or minimum infrastructure. So in Lake Malbina, for instance, in Tasmania, there's a controversy going on right now about the creation of a sort of glamping thing on Halls Island. And with that, we're going to have hardened development coming in to make better access for tourists, whereas it's been a place where people do hiking into it, tramping into it using the New Zealand term. And that requires very little infrastructure. And once you harden the site, then that changes the nature of the place.
And given that we're all going to be travelling and spending time in our own backyards a lot more over the next year or so, it'll be interesting to see where development does occur and where it's fought back from. Freya, it's always great to speak with you. Thanks so much.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Freya Higgins-Debiol, she's a senior lecturer in tourism management at the University of South Australia. We're looking at when tourism infrastructure needs to be built or when nature should be left alone. Music festivals, Jono, is something that I actually didn't even think about until Freya mentioned that, because a lot of the times they're out. They're in really remote areas and they're an ongoing, you know, yearly, annual event.
That really reminds me of the Pyramid Rock Music Festival down on Phillip Island as well. And that was a really, you know, it was a beautiful location because you can see the water from there. There's actually, you can actually see the rock that is shaped like a pyramid. But how do you balance something like that in such a beautiful, pristine environment and make sure that it's not damaging that environment so that people don't want to come back next year? Michael is in Walhalla. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, John. How are you going?
Yeah, very well. So what do you think about where you draw the line between tourism development and protecting the environment?
Well, there is a balancing act, but I think there is part of the reality we've got to keep in mind that with the population continuing to grow, especially in Melbourne, although it's taken a bit of a hit this year, but with the huge population growth, people are coming anyway. So you're better to actually, as Terry was saying, better to manage what's going on and actually try and have some control over it. Otherwise, places just get overrun. And certainly that's what we're experiencing in Walhalla. For years, we've been calling out for just basic infrastructure to be built in town, such as a sewage disposal system, because there is no sewage. And this is a town that normally attracts 120,000 people annually, yet the Shire alone has to spend about $50,000 annually to pump out the toilet blocks and take the wastewater away.
That's a very different argument for a lot of people. It's not, you're not saying, oh, we want to build a boardwalk. You're asking for sewerage. I mean, this is when we're talking about what's not sexy about tourism, sewerage is well and truly at the top of the list.
Yeah. I mean, for a lot of places, the most important thing is having, you know, good public toilets and good toilet facilities. You know, it's, as you say, it's not a very sexy subject. However, it's really basic. And yet here we have a tourist town that attracts, you know, 120,000+ people per annum, and yet there is no actual sewage system. So organisations like our railway, which, you know, carries 35,000 passengers per annum, they have to pay to have all their wastewater disposed of and a truck to arrive to pump it away. Now, our tourist numbers at the moment have, up until the last lockdown, have just been huge. People are coming anyway. We're being overrun on weekends, and yet there's just no money available to actually do some of the basic infrastructure. We have a campsite to the north end of town that had the last investment in it was in 1991. So 30 years ago, it was actually had any form of investment, and it needs a major upgrade to actually be fit for purpose for today's needs.
Still and a lot of work to do by the sounds of it, Michael. But just before you go, can you tell us about what state Walhalla is in now? It was pretty heavily hit by that storm that came through a fortnight ago.
It was. Look, it's all open again. We're still waiting for the railway to reopen. There's still got engineering assessments going on there. There are some areas in town where the road has been cordoned off and it's down to one lane. But basically, we're trying to get back to normal as best we can. Most people visitor in town would only, the only evidence of the flooding would be where the barriers are along the main road. Most of the damage was to public infrastructure, and I hope that what happens now is that those authorities that are actually responsible for the infrastructure actually repair it and rebuild it. Because our biggest fear as a community is that, you know, once the fun and games are over and the drama's done, it dies down, and the emphasis to actually do the basic infrastructure doesn't happen. I mean, our Northbrook Gardens campsite was actually quite badly damaged, and it's actually an opportunity to remodel it and actually rebuild it so it fits for purpose.
So that it fits, yeah. Well, that's a look, and I hope that the locals get what they need in that area. I haven't been there in years. Michael, thank you so much. We used to do a lot of day trips, Jono, growing up to Walhalla, back when it didn't even have electricity, and we would spend plenty of time just wandering around, you know, and go and see the cemetery. It was very hilly. I remember Dad having to carry me a lot of the time.
Very hilly. And if you saw pictures of it a fortnight ago, just water gushing through the creek and lots of damage there. So good to hear that they're back open.
I won't be back with you for a couple of weeks, Jono. You'll be taking the reins. So enjoy, mate.
So that's the Conversation Hour for today. But if you missed the start of this program, or if you know someone who'd be interested in this topic, subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, you can email us at conversationhour@abc.net.au. We'd love to hear from you with any suggestions, comments, questions, and ideas for future shows. Thanks for listening and have a good one.